Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 279. Thank you for tuning in. I'm joined today by the wonderful Greg Jenner. It's a great chat. He's a historian. He's absolutely fascinating. He's the main kind of historian guy on the Horrible Histories team. So, and the new film comes out, Rotten Romans, July 26th. We talk about that a lot. Also, we're hoping he's going to be able to get a little teaser up of his You're Dead to Me podcast, which is on BBC Sounds, and it's fantastic. We talk about that as well. As some of you know, I'm now doing shorter intros so you can get straight to the A, and I'll ramble on more in the outro to give you some information and stuff. But before I do, there's something I have to tell you about this specific episode. Now, I was lent use of the wonderful Muddy Knees Studios. And those guys are great. They do the Totally Football Show, all sorts of really good stuff. So big love for them. But it had been a while since I'd been in a proper like radio studio, since my XFM days and that. So when we started talking, Greg's mic was a little quieter than mine. And so I turned it up, and I was looking at the screen, and it still seemed quiet. So I turned it up a bit more. And I did that for the first 5 minutes or so before realising I was turning my own mic up. So not only was I already louder than him, I was progressively making myself more louder. Now, the beast, Buddy Peace, the greatest podcast producer in the West, he's actually more southeast these days, but anyway, he's tweaked it and made it work. After about 5 minutes, I realised my mistake and levelled it out. But I just wanted to warn you, it might feel a bit jumpy and weird because he's had to raise bits and bring them down. And as you know, I get excited when like it's talking about history or anything like this. So we're going back and forth and we interrupt every now and then. So those bits get a bit confusing and lost. But it's only for the first 5 minutes. After that, it is all good. So I'm going to let you get on with the podcast. Obviously, I'm going to mention patreon.com/scroobiouspip, where you get extra episodes and poem of the month, and speechofanimalrecords.com, where you can buy Distraction Pieces podcast merch and Scroobius Pip merch. But all that aside, I've already mentioned that Horrible Histories is out the 26th of July, and it looks fantastic. It's getting amazing reviews. The You're Dead to Me podcast, hopefully there's a teaser on BBC Sounds, and there's more to come. Dead Famous, An Unexpected History of Celebrity from Bronze Age to Silver Screen, is out in 2020. And his first book, A Million Years in a Day, it's fantastic. We talk about all of that in the podcast, though. So this is the wonderful Mr. Greg Jenner. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. If you're good, we'll jump in.
I kind of sat here
because he said it recording, and it felt weird leaving the room with it recording. I felt I had to keep it company, so I've been kind of sitting here awaiting your return. I did. I've had a little chat because my producer Buddy Peace will get the whole file. So whenever there's a gap, I feel I should talk to him in case he happens to be listening. So I was telling him where we are, and and yeah, it's nice. I'm joined today by Greg Jenner. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm great. It's exciting because we've been talking about lining this up for a while. And it feels like I say this all the time on the podcast, but I'm a big believer in timing, and the timing being right for everyone to have exciting stuff to talk about. And this kind of, there was a few times we almost had it lined up before and it didn't work, and it feels like it's for the better because you've got so many great things going on at the moment.
Yeah,
so
suddenly it was like, actually, I've got like three or four things I can tell you about. That are happening, which is nice. So,
because that's the nightmare thing of anything in the entertainment industry is there is always that long list of things that there's the list of things you can talk about, there's the list of things you can't talk about, and there's the far longer list of things of you're not sure if you can or can't talk about, so it's best to just not talk about because you don't want to get in trouble.
Well, I'm not nearly as important as... mind, so I don't have any kind of studio bosses going, you can't mention that I'm just a bloke who does history stuff.
Yeah.
So I can tell you about most of the things, really.
But that's almost the scarier place to be in, because I've had that on sets before where I've got a small role, so no one specifically told me I can't talk about it, but that's only because I'm so low down. They're probably thinking, well, it doesn't matter if he talks about it, but then it turns out I've got this decent following. So it's that I have an almost greater fear of, because if you're a Samuel L. Jackson and you've been told not to talk about it, but you talk about it, you're Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, I mean,
there's not a lot they can do.
What you don't get to be in our films anymore.
Yeah.
You've been Samuel L. Jackson.
Exactly. Whereas I'm in that place where they could quite fairly say, we're never working with you again, and it'll be complete accident. So, yeah, it's a weird middle ground. But so one of the exciting things that's coming up is the Horrible Histories movie, and we'll get on to that. But before we do, the reason I hit you up initially was because I really enjoy you on Twitter. And again, I think it's going to be something that we talk about. I mean, it's relevant to Horrible Histories. It's relevant to your podcast and your books, that you're fun to follow because you'll give little snippets of history, but you'll make it seem like we're not learning. You'll make it fun and you'll make it kind of entertaining. And that kind of goes across all of your work, really. So Twitter seems like the perfect place to start in many respects. So how have you found that? Because social media can be responsible, obviously, for a lot of misinformation, a lot of huge spreading of myths that become facts because they've been spread. But how have you found using it as a place to go, oh, by the way, here's this cool person from history you've never heard of?
I love it. I mean, I'm a huge Twitter fan. I've been on there since 2011, and it's been really important in my career. It's been really exciting. Just watching the news, you know, the Brexit stuff and everything.
Yeah.
The way the Twitter is now the place I start for news, that's where I go to from the moment that something has broken, you know, some big story. But as a historian, you know, my job title is a weird one. I'm called a public historian, which
right.
is a thing that people are like, what does that mean? And quite often when you type it, autocorrect turns it into pubic historian. People are like, are you a pubic historian? And I'm, well, you know.
I mean, that's a valid job too, I'm sure.
I've done a bit of pubic history, but I'm trying to say public historian. So my job is to communicate history to the public in a way that is engaging and accessible. And mostly I do it with comedy. That's kind of my specialism. There are a lot of historians out there doing great work, but I seem to have found a niche as the guy who works with comedy writers and comedy performers, helping them be funny, but also helping them work at, you know, in a historical way that is factually accurate or captures the spirit of history.
It must be tough to find the balance, right? Because with a lot of the work that is more primarily your work, the focus is education with a sprinkling of entertainment. Whereas with things like Horrible Histories, the focus is probably entertainment, then with a balance of education. KRS-One is one of my favourite rappers, and he used to call, when he went down a route of doing a lot of stuff about black history in his lyrics, he called it edutainment, which I think is a wonderful term. It has to come from the rap world, obviously. It's a weird balance. So how do you find that kind of on both sides of it, on when you're consulting and having to go, right, well, that's there because of a joke, because of this. Yeah. If I ruin it by going, well, technically, you know.
It's the biggest part of my job is trying to not ruin jokes. Because I'm incredibly privileged to work, you know, I've worked in Horrible Histories since 2008. We've been 11 years.
Wow.
And when I joined that show, I was really young, and I was like 24, 25. And I'm now an old man, graying and all that. But what was incredible was the producer, Caroline Norris, who's an incredibly brilliant woman. She immediately went, all right, you're in charge of the history. That's your job. And if at any point we make a sketch that you're not happy with, you tell me.
Yeah.
And if you can convince me, then I'll cut it. So from the moment we did literally series one, terrifying, because I'm in charge of this room of writers, you know, really famous comedy writers, people I've grown up watching their shows. Our director has directed, you know, Partridge and all the amazing shows. Caroline has produced all the shows I love. Everyone in this room is cleverer and funnier and more experienced than I am. But at any point, I can say, sorry, we're not doing this.
Amazing.
And everyone would stop and go, all right, How are we doing it instead? How do you fix this? You know, we've got this great joke, we've got this great idea. How do you fix it? And for me, the huge privilege of being a historian who works with comedians is that you very quickly start to think like a comedian. You start to think like a comedy writer. And I do write on the show. I've written some sketches. I've written some songs on the show. And you start to think, how do I fix this? You know, the history is wrong. We can't do this. But it's such a great gag. How do we come back around at it from a different angle?
It's great from the off that they gave you that power and put that importance in it. And I think it's why in one of my notes, I kind of note that that Horrible Histories is my goddaughter and her sister's favourite show. But
brilliant.
The key part is it's also their mum's favourite.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's great about it, is because there is that focus on the importance of the educational side of it. That doesn't mean you have to take away from the entertainment side. It just means
that
you can have both. Again, not to bring it back to hip hop, but throughout my career, I started off and the focus was all on the content. And then by my second album, I was like, flows and breathing and pausing.
Yeah.
And it was only by my third that I was like, all right, you listen to people like KRS or Big Daddy Kane, and you realise that you don't have to choose between the two.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be either content or technique.
Yeah.
It can be both. And that's, I think, the prime example that Horrible Histories does, is it can be both. It doesn't have to be, oh, it's educational, so it's going to be a BBC tape that you watch in school that's got a bad joke in and bad acting. It can be, you know, everything.
We're a hybrid show, and we had to invent it from scratch. Nothing like it existed before in television history. We had to come up with a new genre of TV called factual sketch comedy, where you're doing sketches and songs and parodies.
And that on paper, that sounds terrible. That sounds so unentertaining.
Dear BBC.
Sounds like the worst thing.
Got this new idea, factual sketch comedy. But the success of the show is that in many ways, although we're a history show, and all the sketches are about history.
Yeah.
Actually, when you watch it, we're a parody of 21st century pop culture.
Yeah.
All our sketches are taking the piss out of movies and telly and adverts and you know, rap and grime and R&B and pop. And we're doing jokes about The Apprentice and MasterChef and quiz shows and movie trailers. And so all the stuff that kids are watching in our show, they immediately go, oh, I get this. I understand it. They understand the vocabulary. They understand the grammar of what they're seeing because it's taking the piss out of a thing that they have already, they live in that world.
Yeah.
So you basically are smuggling history in by going, hey, look, you know this stuff. You're already on board with it.
Yeah.
But let's imagine if Lord Nelson was doing it instead, or you know, an ancient Roman emperor is doing a hip-hop video.
Completely. And I think comedy is the perfect Trojan horse for that.
Because
I think there's been years and years of the youth being quite frankly patronized by people trying to go, well, it's Shakespeare but it's rap, and you know, when done right, Akala's done stuff like that, which has been amazing.
Akala does incredible
stuff. When done right, it's amazing, but for a long time it can be really patronizing. Oh, we're bringing hip-hop into it and we're going to tell you history through, and it's like, leave it, mate. Just leave hip-hop here and history here.
When it's your kind of cool history teacher who's trying to be sort of too cool, and you're like, you're trying too hard. But our thing is that we hire the best writers, we hire the best cast, and we then go, right, okay, what's the funniest story? What's the, you know, we're not trying to teach you history. That's not our job.
Yeah.
We're trying to be cheerleaders for history. We're trying to go, this is a subject that you think is boring and is irrelevant and has got no purpose in your life because you're 8 years old. And why the hell would you care about what happened 300 years ago? But it's great. It's an amazing subject. It's literally everything that's ever happened ever to everyone.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Come enjoy it. Have a laugh. Watch with your family. Watch with your brother and sister. Watch with your, you know, your friends. And then go back to school the next day and ask your teacher for a bit more information. Or go to a museum at the weekend and go, actually, you know, I've seen that on Horrible Histories. I'm going to read that little placard. Or I'm going to, you know, go into the gift shop and buy a little book. We're basically trying to inspire a love for history rather than teach it.
Completely. And it's great because I think one of the keys to getting people interested in stories or individuals is familiarity. I think it's the same with music. I've said a few times, I've been asked to do seminars and stuff about the music industry. And my belief that the key to making a hit is familiarity. If you can get it played a load, if you like it or not, people are going to have it in their head.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Marvel franchise is a perfect example of that. There's certain Marvel films that I don't think were great. I watched them, though, because I'm familiar with the characters and I know them and I want to hear more about them. So if you can get kids to fall in love with certain characters on your show, then learning the history about them isn't going to be boring because it's a character that you're invested in. Definitely. Rather than here's just a random person, here's some stuff that happened 100 years ago.
Exactly that. And that's why we do the music parodies, you know, the music, the song. We've done over 120 songs now, and we've done kind of every genre you can think of. And it's a really effective way of communicating a complicated bit of history by finding a parallel, by going, the most famous example, and these days he's a very controversial fella, but the Smiths and Morrissey.
Yeah.
My producer, Caroline, was a big fan of the Smiths in the 80s. She was really into it. And I was trying to explain Charles Dickens to her. And she was saying, well, what's he like? What's Charles Dickens like? And I was like, oh, he's a really complicated guy. He's very clever. He's very passionate. He cares about the working classes. He's anxious. He gets nervous. Yeah. He worries about money and about class and about his status. But at the same time, he's quite arrogant. He's a bit of a big-headed asshole. But he does care. And he's trying to fight for the little man. But at the same time, he's hanging out with all the posh people. And, you know... And she goes, he's Morrissey. He's just
it.
Morrissey.
That's
and
so good.
As soon as she said that, we're like, yep, he's Morrissey. And that song wrote itself in an afternoon. It's really easy. Because all you're doing is going, this person from history, a bit like this person from modern pop music.
And again, I mean, just to... I mean, this feels like I'm a professional and there's all sorts of segues now. But one of the things... one of my favourite tweets from you, I think someone had tweeted something like, how iconic or what a great... feminist. I think it was Taylor Swift
thing, yeah.
And then you posted, was it a Jeanne de Clisson?
Yeah.
Is that, again, I couldn't remember it and I did some research. Yes, I kind of going, female pirate thing. And it was amazing because do you want to kind of tell us, because it kind of, the tweet was, is there a bigger feminist or has someone done more for women? And then you did a little bit about this woman and
I can't remember the exact quote, but someone, you know, that classic meme on Twitter of like, name a more iconic person than Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Or who's more badass, I think, than Taylor.
That was it,
Who's more bad bitch or something than Taylor Swift. And I just responded really quick. I didn't even think about it. I literally just off the top of my head went, well, okay, here's Jeanne de Clisson. Jeanne de Clisson was a French noblewoman in the, I think, 13th century, but don't quote me on that, but medieval, whose husband was killed by the king. And so she embarked on a life of terrifying piracy and just... according to the stories, that they might not be accurate, according to the stories, just sort of spent a decade raiding the high seas, capturing all the French crews and killing every single one of them, apart from like one sailor who'd be allowed to survive to tell the story that Jeanne de Clisson had done this.
It's amazing.
And you just sort of go, okay,
the, My Revenge.
The My Revenge.
Yeah, and it's just...
You know, it's one of the stories you kind of go, it's probably not true. But it sort of speaks to a sense that when we talk about modern pop culture and then we talk about, you know, celebrities, and I'm writing a book about the history of celebrity, so I'm really interested in celebrity. We often talk about them as like bad boys and bad girls and, you know, these people who are, you know, really provocative and they don't play by the rules. And you kind of go, I mean, history is literally full of people went around murdering, you know, Vlad the Impaler literally impaled 20,000 people on stakes and built a human fence out of them.
And you
go, like, where do you start, you know, in terms of Taylor Swift compared to that?
Why was he a bad boy? Or celebrity is a fascinating thing. It's something I was kind of discussing and thinking about a lot 3 years ago, because in 2016, we saw a lot of celebrity deaths.
Yeah.
But we'd also seen a fair few in 2015. Mm. And my kind of theory was, well, celebrity kind of came about in the 60s with the Beatles, or the modern form of celebrity. Therefore, we're that far on that... we should each year see an increased amount of celebrity deaths because that's when celebrities kind of started, or our form of celebrity. So they're all going to be, it's 50, 60, 70 years on. So each year there's been more celebrities. Therefore, we're going to see more deaths as we go on, was my kind of weird theory on
it. It's a nice approach. So my book is out next spring. So I've not finished it yet, so I can't tell you exactly what's in it. I've written 90% of it.
If you want to use my theory, you're very
But welcome. I'm a historian, so when I started writing it, I started 4 years ago. It's been a huge amount of work, this project, and I started thinking, well, when does celebrity start?
Yeah.
When does it start? Because you've said 50s, 60s, that's really interesting. Most sociologists were like, okay, 1910.
Right.
Hollywood. Let's say when films first arrive, that's celebrity. As a historian, my job is to go, all right, is that true? And as it turns out, for the past 10, 15 years, that's been a really interesting new area of historical research into what's called celebrity studies, where some historians have gone, all right, let's really look at this. And in my book, I argue celebrity starts in about 1700.
Right.
So it's about 300 years old.
Wow.
And It's incredible. It's all there. It's all. It's 1720s, 1730s. All the stuff you think of as celebrity, it's already happening in London and Paris in 1720s. But your theory of the kind of glut of celebrity deaths we're expecting to get now does hold true, because there is this huge new intake of celebrities in the 50s and 60s because of the birth of television.
Yeah.
And television gives you a strange new form of intimacy.
Mm. Yeah, of course.
And so there's this thing called parasocial interactions. That's the psychological name for when you think you know someone because you've seen them on the TV and you're like, I know you. And they're like, no, we've never met. And, you know, today you and I have met for the first time.
Yeah.
But we've been chatting for 5 years on Twitter or whatever.
Well, I was going to say, the whole start of my career in music was that because I kind of blew up out of nowhere, we were suddenly doing tons of radio and TV. And I'd always kind of, I always remember it as Zane Lowe up the road at Radio 1, just walking towards and seeing him outside and going, Zane. And then as I was walking towards thinking, oh, we've never met.
Yeah.
I'm doing this in a really familiar way, but just because I've seen him on TV and heard him on every voiceover ever,
that's it.
I was like, Zane!
And that's a parasocial interaction. That is what's called a one-sided, lopsided interaction where you have false intimacy with a celebrity.
Podcasts must be a massive part of that.
Hugely so, because podcasts are so intimate.
Yeah.
Because it's conversational, you're in the ears. You know, I listen to loads of pods. Like when I'm asleep or in bed trying to get to sleep, and for me it's a really important part of my battling insomnia, and I listen loads when I walk, so I really really love podcasts as a really intimate form of conversation with people that you grow really close to. You get the in jokes, you get the favorite guests who come back, but in the 50s and 60s you get that with telly. People are in your living room,
they come into your house.
You know, so it's not like you go to the movies and you pay your money and you sit down and, you know, popcorn and there's a big screen
and there's this
gorgeous superstar up on the screen, you know, beautiful, amazing costumes.
You're entering their world at that point.
You're going to a spectacle.
Yeah.
And it's almost theatrical. Telly brings people into your living room. And of course, that means pop stars. That means TV talk show hosts like, you know, Wogan and people who became part of the furniture.
Yeah.
So when they started dying, because they're hitting their 70s and 80s, or of course Bowie, you know, younger, there was a real profound shock because these people had been part of the landscape, hugely important in our culture, but they'd also been part of our family lives. We'd been sat around with our mums and dads and our brothers and sisters growing up watching Top of the Pops or those kind of shows.
I mean, I also think it's going to sound odd, but the advent in kind of the 80s of mobile media, of portable media, makes a big difference in the intimacy that we have, because all of a sudden Bowie is soundtracking our journey to school or our journey to work. It's in our ears. And again, it was the first time we'd had that. There's soundtracks in films all the time, but for the first time we had our own soundtracks that we're seeing the world with this background. And I think that hugely increases the intimacy because it's taken it along with us.
Absolutely. And the stories that people, I quote in my introduction to my book, I began writing the book the day that Bowie died.
Right.
It's a weird coincidence. I literally woke up at 8 a.m. to get working on this book and switched on Twitter and top story, David Bowie.
Wow. Yeah.
And of course it had been such a shock because he'd kept it from everyone. And I switched on Lauren Laverne's show on Six Music, and the whole show was just a tribute, and people were phoning in and sending in emails with their favourite memories. And it was amazing the way that this man, you know, we sort of joke about him as like a sort of alien, you know, he kind of was otherworldly, but he had impacted...
Well, him and Prince in the same year, Prince was the first act I ever saw that it felt like I was watching something that wasn't from this earth, as stupid as it sounds. Every other band, Springsteen, I think, is one of the best performers ever, yet I watched him and it felt like... That's a bloke up there playing guitar.
Because he's sort of blue collar and he's kind of...
Doing songs, yeah. And Prince, it was like, what's that? this is amazing. And Bowie and Prince were the same in that way.
I've just this morning been reading an essay about Prince in the London Review of Books, which is a fantastic essay. Exactly that, how extraordinary he was. And of course, you know, he was black. He was performing a sort of a sexuality that was confusing and provocative because on stage he was, you know, he sort of was effeminate and masculine simultaneously.
Yeah.
He confused people and he alarmed people and he seduced people. An incredible musician. Phenomenal number of musicians who can match him is like, what, three, four maybe?
Yeah.
So you're right. Prince, Bowie in the same year. There was a sort of sense that we had lost something profound.
Yeah.
but also, as you say, the intimacy of having been able to walk to school or in the car, like commuting to work and just listening to your favourite albums.
It was a really interesting one because both of them, it felt like it was a sad loss. Because I was a bigger Prince fan than a Bowie fan. I love Bowie, but I was really, I am a really big Prince fan. And I quite quickly, because again, it's weird. It's because it was a weird day for me when Prince died. Because I was shooting a music video that day,
right.
So we were in the middle of prepping it when that happened. And then it's like, right, that's my favorite, possibly my favorite musician has died, and action. So it's that kind of a weird thing. But I don't know if that fast forwarded, but quite quickly, I was like, well, I've still got all of his music.
Yep.
We weren't and probably would never have been mates. So that being, the physical being leaving the world, isn't actually changing my relationship with him.
It doesn't undo him, does it?
Our relationship kind of remains the same because we were never going to meet.
No, I mean, the more traumatic thing is when a sort of huge celebrity is outed as being someone deeply problematic, or they've committed crimes that suddenly come out. And, you know, I think I'm not obviously an expert on American comedy, but the Cosby thing was huge because he had been this incredible role model.
Yeah, a real father figure. And again, at the era when, particularly in Black America, I'd imagine it was the start of a family being in your living room.
Yeah.
That was kind of 60s, 70s. Sorry, was that kind of time that
the
was
sitcom
really
coming in? And also, of course, you know, he played this incredible character who'd been a huge hit on network television, but was also a respectable professional Black man who had a good career and had you know, kids and was this sort of, you know, it was showing this incredibly progressive idea of what the American family could be, not just white people.
Yeah.
And so the trauma of the fact that he is this rapist, who is this appalling predator, has sort of undone his career for a lot of people, and they can't enjoy it anymore. They can't go back and enjoy it.
And again, it's not as easy as, oh, it's someone I liked. If it was someone who really inspired and gave a lot of young Black men and women something to aspire to let them know that they could be this huge star, that all these different things were available, that is a bigger thing to lose. That's not just I feel uncomfortable listening to R. Kelly now.
Yeah,
you know, not the end of the world. I'll live without R. Kelly. Fuck that guy. Kind of thing. It's not the same as that.
I'm into some rock and metal, and you know, I quite like Lost Prophets back in the day, and now I just can't listen to them because it feels
completely
weird, and it's not the band member's fault. It's not the guitarist's fault or the drummer's fault, but I can't listen to that band anymore.
No.
So you can lose an attachment and an intimacy with a recording artist or an actor or someone you really respect and so on. But I think what's more complicated is when someone has changed the landscape.
Yeah.
And we've seen that with Michael Jackson, of course, as well.
A great example. I mean, the subject of celebrity is an interesting one. I've got a song called The Struggle, and a lot of people think it's about Johnny Depp being a serial killer, because it has the line, "My name is Johnny Depp and I kill people," and it's all about Johnny Depp going around killing people. But the actual below this, that's the base level story that Johnny Depp is. It was before any domestic stuff came out, and he became a darker character. But as a theory, an actor spends time in all different parts of the world. So if they were to kill people, it'd be hard to time together. It'd be a weird thing to go, oh, there was a murder here. There was also one in Jamaica last week.
Right.
You know, but so it was this weird theory. But the point of it was to kind of look at and dissect the nature of celebrity and the bizarreness that we hold. We push celebrities into a completely different world to the one we live in, but then hold them by our standards. And the easiest example I always give is Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus, when both of them were having these huge backlashes of, oh, they're a prick, they're so rude. It's like, well, since the age of about 13 or 14, they've been able to have anything they want, do anything they want. You can't expect them, I'm not excusing them, but you can't expect them to be normal people.
No.
And that's kind of the weird thing of this thing. We love having celebrities, an endless list of celebrities to follow, to look at, to watch, to fawn over, to idolise, to hate. But then we get furious when they don't act the same. And again, often they do act the same. Like if Mary at work, it comes out that she's cheating on her husband, it'll be, oh, have you heard about Mary? If Kylie Jenner cheats on her husband, it'll be, what a disgraceful, disgusting role model. And all this is like, well, no, these are quite, they're humans put into situations that are new to humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's a bizarre world.
I'm hoping that you're going to like my book because I've got all that stuff in there.
Excellent.
That's exactly that. I mean, I'm a historian, so the book is from 1700 to about 1950. But I do write about Miley Cyrus quite early on in the book because I have to explain what celebrity is. And she's a really interesting case study because she goes through three different types of celebrity.
Yeah.
But
I think she's an underrated and important one as well because despite part of her shock that she was causing was she was openly saying, I'm not straight or gay. I take what I fancy. Do you know what I mean? I'm attracted to what I'm attracted to and things like that. Whereas it was at the peak of her being kind of demonised as she's thrusting half naked on this. And it's like, well, that's not great. But the role model of not having to label your sexuality is a really positive role model.
And I think part of the problem also is that she had come out of the Disney thing. So people were judging her as a kind of Disney role model.
Yeah.
She was like, well, I'm a young woman. I can do what I want. But she obviously lent into the sort of sexualization thing. And she, you know, she did do things like give, you know, I think someone was a dancer wore a Bill Clinton mask and she performed a sort of fake blowjob. And you kind of go, all right, that is definitely pushing the envelope a bit.
Yeah.
But
where's the art here again?
But ultimately, Madonna was provocative in the 80s and 90s. The Rolling Stones were provocative in the 60s and 70s.
100%.
Lord Byron was provocative in 1812.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, these things are part of being a celebrity. So you have to generate heat. You've got to create a provocation.
And I mean, speaking of the role model status attached to being a Disney star, it's kind of that was ignored by Disney.
Yeah.
Like, again, he's not a good example of role model or positivity or humanity in any way. So it's like, it's mad that that's something that...
But he's played by lovely Tom Hanks in the movie.
Makes him adorable.
It makes him lovely and the all-American hero. Celebrity is functional. It has a role in society. And I talk about that in the book. And the book's called Dead Famous.
Yeah.
And it will be out next spring if you want to read it.
But... An unexpected history of celebrity from the Bronze Age to the silver screen, right?
Thank you very much.
There we go. Let's get the full plug in.
It's really interesting because on the one hand, you kind of want to go, what are celebrities for? They're a waste of space, yada, yada, yada. But from a sociological point of view, they are really important. They play a very powerful role in society. They are the prisms and the ciphers through which a huge amount of our ethical conversations happen. We engage with ideas of right and wrong, of morality and immorality, of sexual liberty and conservatism. We, you know, through them, we often find where the line is for us.
Yeah.
And we use them as entertainment. We use them as vicarious blood offering, sacrificial victims almost. You know, when Britney Spears had a sort of really tough spell and she shaved her head and everyone was like, oh my God, is she having a meltdown?
Yeah.
I think there was a really interesting South Park episode where they were talking about her being sacrificed to this sort of ancient cultic god. And it was a really powerful bit of comedy because South Park is an amazing show and it's funny, but every now and then it absolutely hits the nail on the head. And that one felt really precise to me.
I mean, so to kind of, we'll bring this gradually back round to the Horrible Histories movie, but I think it's interesting. What's your take on the importance of representation, accurate representation in dramatised kind of films, because we touched upon Tom Hanks as Walt Disney.
Yeah.
I love Saving Mr. Banks.
It's a lovely
my
film.
Thought on that is it's not a Walt Disney biopic. It's weird because I've discussed this with Dexter Fletcher, with Alan Hughes, and with numerous different people. And because I remember the Straight Outta Compton film, a lot of people were angry that it didn't go into Dr. Dre's history of domestic abuse, which is horrific. And I agree with that. I kind of posted at the time saying how much I love the film, but let's remember some other stuff while we're giving all this praise. And I don't think it's a case of trying to beat anyone down. I think it's trying to give perspective. But equally, I also feel, using Straight Outta Compton as an example, it's not a Dr. Dre biopic, it's an NWA biopic. Mm-hmm. There was about 4 minutes given to Dr. Dre's brother dying.
Yeah.
So you can't cover absolutely everything. So that must be something that, as a historian as well, and your input, it's like, right, you want to cover everything, but at the end of the day, it's not a lecture. It's not a book. It's not a paper. It's a piece of entertainment. So you have to kind of pick and choose.
This is a really interesting area of conversation for me. And I, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see I talk about this a huge amount.
Yeah.
And I teach this. I teach at a couple of universities, so York University and Royal Holloway, which I studied at York, and Royal Holloway very kindly made me an honorary research associate, which is a very fancy title for a bloke who turns up every now and then and talks a bit. But I work as a historical advisor to movies and drama and comedy, of course.
Yeah.
And my job is often to facilitate the storytelling and to help the creatives, the screenwriter, the producer, the actors, the musicians, whoever it is, to tell the best story they can. And I'll give them as much information as possible. And there are fantastic consultants like Hannah Gregg at York, who is she was consultant recently on The Favourite, which won all those Oscars, and she'd done Poldark.
It's one of the things I enjoy on your social media as well, is you'll normally give a bit of a fact and then link to someone who's knows more about it.
My job, go,
here's some stuff I know, but you should read this person's book.
My job is a middleman. I'm a middle person. I am a public historian, means my job is to represent academic knowledge to the public. And quite often that means taking really complicated, sophisticated, highbrow, nuanced stuff and going, well, that's a bit tricky for the general public who've only got 10 minutes. I'll make it a bit easier to listen to. But if people ask me something on Twitter, most of the time I will go, here's a brilliant historian.
Yeah.
And Twitter is amazing for that. I follow 9,000 people on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I'm followed by about 70,000, I think, which is great. And what's amazing is that I can get any question answered about any subject in world history in about 20 minutes.
That's any amazing. Question. That's such a great pool
of
people.
There are thousands of historians on there, and absolutely everyone on there knows someone on there who knows the answer to your question.
Yeah.
So you can literally go, all right, what... I want to know what people wear in China in the 1320s on their heads.
Yeah.
And within two people, I can kind of go, I know someone who knows something about China, and they'll know someone who knows about 14th century China, and they'll know someone who knows about fashion in 14th century China.
Love it.
Within 20 minutes, you get your answer. And it's fantastic. So that in itself is amazing. But in terms of drama and comedy and film, I'm a very strong believer in allowing creatives to be creative, because that's the storytelling. That's, you know, Homer did it in the Iliad, the Gilgamesh, and so on.
Yeah.
In the Bronze Age stories going back. Shakespeare changed history. You cannot do an accurate movie. It cannot be done because the past is vast and complicated and messy, and we can't even understand it properly as historians when you write a massive chunky book, because there's always things we don't know. We don't have all the evidence. And also, sometimes you just don't know how things went. So Richard III, did he kill the princess in the tower? Yes or no? You can show that in a movie, but you can't show him doing it and not doing it.
Yeah.
He can't be a quantum king. He
yeah.
can't be simultaneously the bad guy wronged by history and the villain Shakespeare writes about.
Yeah.
You've got to make a choice.
Can't be Heidegger's king.
No, you can't. Exactly that.
Or Schrodinger's, sorry.
Schrodinger's king. And you have to make choices. And so my job as an advisor is to help people make the best choices where possible. Obviously, I'll say to them, that is not accurate.
Mm.
Here's what would be accurate. It would be great if you could do that instead. But my argument goes that overwhelmingly the power of historical media, and increasingly it's computer games now, actually, like Assassin's Creed and games like that, having a massive impact on how young people engage with the past.
That's fascinating.
So really important that we switch onto that. And there's lots of really good historians doing that now, switching onto computer games and gaming as a world of accessing information about the past.
Yeah.
But it's so important that, for me, you allow creatives to be creative, but that they work with historians during that creative process. And then when a thing comes out and is shown on the BBC or shown in the cinema, then you need to have space available for historians to comment. So like you said about when, you know, the Straight Outta Compton came out and you went onto Twitter and people trust you, they follow you, they know that you're knowledgeable, passionate, you've watched the movie and you've gone, yeah, I've enjoyed this, but here's some ancillary information.
Yeah.
That's what historians do on Twitter. That's what we need to do in the media. That's what we need to, you know, that's what historians do when you invite them on. So I very strongly believe in allowing creatives to be creative, but then allowing a follow-up space for historians to explain, explore, converse, talk to the public and go, look, it's great that you've loved, you know, Taboo.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of phone calls when Taboo came out,
which
I loved. I thought Taboo was brilliant fun.
Great.
I think it's really well made. I think it's well acted. I think it was funny. I think it was actually accurate in quite a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I got interviewed by lots of newspapers because of the swearing.
Yeah.
So the Times, the Telegraph phone me up and go, Greg, this is very sweary. Did they have swearing? And he's like, of course they had swearing. I mean, what it's called, they're not like Mary Whitehouse.
Yeah,
these are,
yeah.
you know, soldiers and pirates and politics. These are people yeah. who argue, who get passionate. Of course they had swearing. But it doesn't matter if it's accurate anyway.
Yeah.
It's a story. It's
yeah, completely.
It's a creative story. It's interpretation. It's not even an accurate history per se. It's imagined yeah. characters.
Completely.
And what we're doing when we tell stories about the past is often we're telling stories about ourselves.
Yeah.
The past is often a mirror to our own personal interests, in the same way that celebrities are as well. Yeah. So when you choose to make a story about the 1820s, quite often you're picking that because it's fascinating to us now in 2019.
Yeah.
Completely. 2020,
yeah.
because what are we going? What's our current obsession? We're obsessed with sex. We're obsessed with gender identity. We're obsessed with violence, knife crime. We're obsessed yeah. with politics and with global warming
yeah.
and with fashion and violence and the roles of men and women. You know,
when I was reading the script, just seeing everything about how the East India Company were kind of more powerful than the powers that be. And you can compare that so much to now, how there are all these corporations and people
yeah.
behind who are backing this political party or that political party. And that was the bit that got me. I was like, this is now.
Yeah,
this
I mean, the East India Company was basically Google with an army.
Yeah. yeah
I mean,
yeah,
they
yeah.
ran a country, they ran an economy,
yeah.
they got to make the rules. They came back into the British governmental control relatively late in the 19th century, you know, late 19th century, I can't remember the exact date, but from the 1700s through to, you know, 1820s, 1830s, they are a kind of commercial arm with their own force.
Yeah.
And they can levy taxes and they can do what they like. And it's scary. And
yeah.
and that's sort of the thing that speculative fiction or sci-fi or something like Years and Years or Black Mirror might
yeah.
move towards in the future and go, in the future, the tech companies will rule us all. It'll be
yeah.
a robot. But actually, historically speaking, there was this huge economic corporation running Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And they were allowed to get away with it.
Yeah. They had the power.
They had a tremendous power and yeah. very little oversight. And a shitload of people were killed horribly,
yeah.
you know, either starved or disease or in war because of this powerful imperial commercial operation.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that excited me about Taboo as a story was that it was a period piece that for the first time didn't hide, or for one of the first times that I was aware of, didn't hide from the fact that all the glitz and glamour was built on the graves of people with darker skin.
Yeah.
And I loved that the first script I read hinted at that in the first episode. And
yeah.
I was like, that's awesome that this is going the period route, which the British love. We love a period drama.
We
can't get enough of it.
But
so much of it is quite literally a whitewashed.
Yeah, it's bonnets and bustles.
Story.
It's,
yeah.
it's one of the real things about the attraction to history as an entertainment genre is there's this oppositional desire. And I often say that there's a few ways to spin it, but ultimately we come to historical dramas for kind of either reassurance and romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
So we want the past to be lovely and nice and different
yeah.
because the modern world is full of traffic and noise and, you know, knife crime. And we're like, oh, God, it's awful.
Yeah.
I just want to watch Downton Abbey with people, you know, nice frocks, nice hats.
Yeah.
Or you get the oppositional. You get the thing that the past was nasty and brutal and
yeah.
savage, and there were no protections and no welfare system and no safety net, and you could be mugged or stabbed on the street.
Yeah.
And Taboo feeds into that
yeah.
concept
yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
Taboo is so gritty and grimy
yeah.
and raw, and there's very little romance, and there's some lovely costumes, but
yeah.
they are dirty and they
yeah.
are torn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you get that sort of split. You get Ripper Street on one side
yeah.
and Downton on the other side. And
completely.
Often history is pulled in those directions. And the truth is, it's both of those things.
Yeah.
The truth is that there were wealthy people in nice hats, and there were street kids, and there were slaves, and there were people who were brutalized and victimized and sold and bought and killed
yeah.
so that someone else could make an awful lot of money. And I think we're starting to see, hopefully now, we're starting to see more awareness of black history, of colonial history, of the impact that empire did to people. You know, Akala's book, recent book,
yeah.
you know, it's a fantastic book, you know, and he's not a historian per se, but he's done a fantastic job.
Yeah.
And I definitely recommend giving it I've got the audiobook, it's fantastic.
He's amazing. When I had him on the podcast, it was like, well, as you say, he's not a historian per se, but
dear God, does he know a lot about,
oh, he's done his reading.
About history. You know, he's knows, done his reading, yeah. He knows his stuff. A Black Earth Rising was another one. It feels like it's, I'm just praising the BBC now, but that was another one that seemed to just do a really good job of telling a complex story that I hadn't heard told before, and seeing that throughout the history of Africa, the liberators can become the people that need to be liberated from quite quickly and in within a generation and things like that. And it can be this kind of the resistance, the counterculture becomes the culture as such. And it's fascinating.
We're living in a time, I think, where we've seen the Windrush generation betrayed by their own government, you know, and it's not like these people had been allowed into the country. They were British. They are British people. And they have been stripped of their citizenship.
Yeah.
And you just go, that would not happen to white people.
No, completely.
So it's really, you know, we have to be better at talking about empire, and we have to be talking about the impact of legacy and the way in which institutional racism has been propped up by history and the way that history is taught as well.
Yeah.
So part of my job on Horrible History is part of my job as a communicator. And I'm not a specialist on empire. There are much better people than me. But part of my job is to kind of go, look, you can't just keep banging on about Winston Churchill and Henry VIII.
Yeah.
There's this whole other part of the world that we went and interfered in, and the legacy of that is still with us.
Yeah.
So, but dramas like Taboo are hugely influential in changing that. And so I'm hugely in favour of movies, drama, games, books, rap, whatever, engaging in these ideas, even if they're slightly not entirely accurate.
Yeah.
Because they start a conversation.
I couldn't agree more. I think things like Detroit the other year was a fantastic film, and it's a thing that I'd watched numerous documentaries. I always seem to bang on about when someone's going to do a good drama about the LA riots.
Yeah.
Because there's some amazing documentaries and some amazing books, but there's an area of people that's probably the majority who aren't going to sit down and pop on a documentary or read this historical book. So yeah, I think it's so rife for it, particularly as we're at a point now where we've got amazing black writers and black producers in Hollywood who lived through that.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. But anyway, aside from that, I'm not going off on that tangent again. History is pretty big.
Yeah.
So, and you're coming up on the 8th series of Horrible Histories, I believe.
The 8th one's currently on TV, yeah.
So how was it to decide what to focus on in the film? Because the film is a big decision to go, right,
huge
now we've got to go where we're going to go. Because the series, you can kind of go where you want, but the film, you have to go, right, here's what we're focusing on.
It's really difficult, and it's such a challenge. I mean, at university, I studied history, obviously, as a historian, but I wrote my master's on movies about King Arthur.
Yeah.
So, and my favourite, of course, is Monty Python's Holy Grail, which is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
So I was already aware of the fact that how difficult it is to go from sketch to movie, because Python had done exactly that. They'd gone from sketch to movie.
Yeah.
And picking a story was really difficult for them, and they took a long time to find the idea of Holy Grail. And for us, it was the same thing. It's like, we've done everything. We've done the history of the world from the Stone Age up to Martin Luther King. What are we going to do a 90-minute movie
focus on?
For?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the story, very quickly, we were like, okay, well, we kind of want a kind of, not a love story at all, but we want a kind of boy meets girl type story, but we want to change it. We don't want it to be romantic. We want it to be about friendship and about a bond, a respect. But we need them to start on opposite sides.
Yeah.
We need them to have a kind of enmity to begin with, and they can then gradually learn to respect each other. And very quickly, it was like, all right, well, there's a few avenues that give you that. But perhaps the most iconic one, going back in terms of what we've done in the series and so on, is you... the Roman and Celtic kind of opposition, you know, the idea of Boudicca versus the Romans.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of fun with it. We had a really great song earlier on in the series that that Martha sang. And we thought, well, that gives you quite a lot of leeway. And also because the Celts were a kind of interesting culture in that women were relatively emancipated and they could do a lot of stuff. They could own property. They could possibly even be warriors. It was like, okay, well, it'd be quite fun then to invert the usual expectation.
Yeah.
And instead of having a sort of big, strong, strapping Roman soldier, we have a slightly weedy Roman boy, really,
yeah,
who's sort of chucked in the Roman army against his will. And he comes to Britain, and there's a wannabe Celt warrior who's a girl.
Yeah.
And they're enemies, but they sort of start in slightly oppositional positions of where you might expect boy meets girl to be.
Yeah.
So she's the kind of wannabe warrior, and he's the kind of nerd who likes reading scrolls. He's really into he's really into science and poetry, and he's not at all butch.
Yeah.
So that felt like a really interesting place, and so I did a lot of research and gave it to producers Caroline and Giles and Dom, and then we had a fantastic screenwriter called Jess, and we went like, okay, that feels like a world that we can build. And then once you've done that, you've got Boudicca and Nero as your big famous kind of secondary characters, and then our invented characters of Atti and Orla as our imagined teenagers who sort of meet through Empire again. It's the story of Empire and invasion and resistance, and
again, it's a beautiful thing there, not to bring it back to Taboo, but it's a beautiful thing of finding that point of history and then creating some fictional characters within that history to give you that leeway, so you don't have to change anything that feels criminal to change, or add anything that feels criminal to add. You can go, well, here's our historical figures, here's our people who could have been real or could not, you know. So let's that gives you that freedom to focus on the quality of the story and the film rather than just here's the historical accuracy.
Exactly that. You wanted obviously Nero and Boudicca because they're big names and they are fun, and they, you know, they help market the film and all that, and we've got really funny actors in all the roles. And
I was going to say, was that a big thing? Because pals of mine and previous guests, Nick Frost and Kate Nash.
Is in it. Kate Nash is fantastic. She's Boudicca, Kate, and she said she spent her whole life wanting to play Boudicca.
Yeah, of course.
You know, she's red-haired, and she was so up
100%.
For it.
As soon as I looked at that on IMDb, I was like, well, obviously, she's going to have been all over that.
It was a very easy bit of casting. She was like, I definitely want to do this.
Yeah.
And then Nick Frost plays Orla's dad. He's sort of a chieftain, and he's having such a fun... He's so funny in it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
looks
him really
well.
In
the trailer.
I've not met him before,
but
he's just the funniest guy, and he's so expressive, and he's full of heart in it, and he's this sort of dad who really wants his daughter not to get harmed, but she's desperate to be a warrior. You know, it's a really lovely piece of acting.
It feels like you've done a really good job, you as a team, I'm saying here, kind of doing that thing of being aware that the move from TV to silver screen has to be a jump.
Yeah.
So add in some big names, some of the right people, but then equally not just going, well, it's not going to feel like horrible histories. The Boudicca and sorry, not Boudicca, the couple
the French crew,
aren't huge names.
No, they
aren't. You know, so they're the kind of key to the story.
Yep.
But you've not gone, well, who's a huge actor? You've put these huge actors in these bigger actors that are new additions to the horrible histories kind of world. You've put them in key roles, but not as the primary focus. So it doesn't feel like, oh, it's a Nick Frost film or it's a Kate Nash film or whatever
else. It's also a movie for families and for kids. And so we wanted young leads, of course, your teens. And so our two leads are Sebastian Croft and Amelia Jones, and they are incredible. They have ludicrous chemistry and amazing charisma, and they're going to be huge stars, and there'll be loads of stuff. And as soon as we saw them doing the screen test, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah,
these two people can carry a film, which is mad because they are literally like doing their A-levels or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you drop in the kind of big names around them. So Nick Frost is obviously fantastically funny. Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City plays Nero's mum, and she's just really, really good at it. And then Craig Roberts
right
is very funny Nero, who's playing in a really different way than you might expect. His Nero's sort of slightly annoyed, frustrated, sort of mumbling Welsh kind of Nero that's a very different take on it.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. And then there's loads of people from British comedy, Alexander Armstrong, Warwick Davis. Just a massive cast of cameo people. You're like, oh, that person, Lee Max in it, he's really funny. Jamie Dimitriou.
He's amazing.
There's just funny people everywhere. Yeah. But they're doing really lovely, focused, just character stuff.
Yeah, and it feels like you can do that because of the respect that Horrible Histories has earned over the years. I think it's not seen as a kid's show, or whatever else. It caught my attention because it seemed like it had so much respect from actors, from grown-ups kind of thing. So it feels like that's a great thing that you can have all these people in there, because I mean, also a lot of them, I'm sure, have got kids, and I'm that kind of exciting thing of, well, my kids love it, so yeah, I'll definitely do that.
But. Absolutely, and of course, it's such a, being in a movie is a really different experience. But we have the loveliest crew. We've got the team is incredibly just creative, collaborative, warm, and fun. It's a lot of fun making Horrible Histories.
Yeah,
I mean the budgets are always crap.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's nothing. It's not like a Netflix drama. We, you know, it's a low budget British indie.
But such an annoying thing that
all the money's on screen.
Yeah,
and
you
it's
do it
really
successfully for a low budget, and instead of getting more budget, you get more episodes or more to do. It's you did great with nothing, so we'll give you nothing again. It's like, what? That isn't that. It's not what we're trying to say.
No, the BBC have been so supportive, and we, you know, there's no other show they would have brought back eight seasons in a row, which has been so incredible. But we are very expensive for a kid's show, but the money doesn't go far enough sometimes for what we're trying to do, because we're trying to do like all of history. Our movie is
and historical stuff always needs big sets or locations.
Sets, locations, costumes, you know, straight out the gate you're doing
the budgets
are
up there.
Thousands and thousands just on wigs, you know, like you've got a lovely beard, you're all right, but you need all the sort of just the kind of makeup trailer is incredible, the amount of stuff they keep in there.
I was looking at Kate and Nick and confused as to why my name wasn't on there, because literally I would have saved you a fortune on beards, hair. I could not wash for a while.
Well, if we do a Viking one, we'll get you in, Pip, because you know, you've definitely got a bit of a Norse look. So it's a really lovely film. What's surprising about it, actually, and it took us 4 years to get off the ground, and so I'm so delighted to be here telling you about it, but what's surprising is that when you do Horrible Histories, the TV show, it's all about the poo and the wee and the slapstick and the kind of high-energy visual style. Yeah. It's really, really kind of anarchic. And this film is really charming and sweet and lovely and anarchic. So,
I thought it's great that in the trailer you make it clear, there are still going to be poo and wee or fart jokes or whatever. You'd think the trailer might just gloss over. It's like, no. To be clear.
There are toilet jokes aplenty, I promise you. And there's some sort of, you know, some a little bit of casual violence, nothing too horrible, but, you know, it's about war, you know, it's back to secrets. But at the heart of it is this really lovely story that I did not expect to be in there when we first started, and I thought it would be kind of really nasty and grim, and it's not. It's really lovely, and kids who have seen it at preview screenings, we've had incredible feedback from kids who just immediately connect with the two leads and are learning some history along the way, but they're emotionally invested in their friendship.
It sounds like a weird comparison, and it might be because it's on my mind because I recorded a podcast with Danny Boyle earlier in the week, but his film yesterday, there's so much that feels similar there in the guy in the lead, Hamish, I can't remember his surname. As soon as he was in, they were like, this is the guy. He can carry this whole film. He's not a big name, so we're going to have to fight for him. It sounds so similar to that pair. But then also it is that I went in thinking, it's a cool concept, but is that going to work over a whole film? Yeah. And it was exactly that. As soon as you see the couple and the friends, it's just, you can, it's the podcast thing.
Yeah.
You can listen to mates chat for ages once you feel like one of their mates. Yeah. And that was this on screen. I was like, the whole concept of the Beatles thing is almost secondary because I'm just invested in what these kids are doing or what these guys are doing. Yeah. And it feels like a similar thing there. You've got this huge historical story that you suddenly shrink down to this intimate relationship and interaction.
It's a friendship between two people, and then on the macro scale, it's about an empire versus a resisting colony in rebellion. So you go massive macroscopic and tiny microscopic, and you get this really lovely film. And it's a musical. There's songs in it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some sort of dancing. There's some all the stuff that you expect from Horrible Histories. But it's a film, and it works as a film. Yeah. It's a 90-minute story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And along the way, there's some toilet jokes and some very, very funny lines and some wonderful performances. And then, you know, a big song and dance number at the end. And it kind of ticks all the boxes you want. But it's really different to the sketch show in a lot of ways. But it's really lovely. I've seen it three times. And every time I'm like, it's so much better than it should be. Because, you know, this is our first film. You think maybe we would have slightly got something a bit wrong. But it really works.
And I love, as you said, that it's a way of introducing people to periods of history and to parts of history and give them the option to find out more. And one of the ways they can find out more is your new BBC podcast.
Yeah.
You're dead to me because one of the people covered in that is Boudicca.
Yeah.
So again, it's a perfect thing to go, here's Kate Nash's Boudicca. Isn't that a cool as fuck character? Here's some more information on it.
Yeah, is it true? Yeah.
I listened to the Blackbeard episode. I really like the format of it. Kind of, I like it arrogantly because it's really similar to how Say Why to Drugs Work, which is a podcast I do with Susie Gage. And the idea of that is we've got an expert and we've got someone who will just talk about them a lot. So my role in Say Why to Drugs is, in my youth, I've done a lot of the drugs. Mm-hmm. I don't do any now, but I'm perfectly happy to talk about my experiences. And the thing that Susie does there is she'll talk about the facts and the popular myths, mm-hmm. and then she'll explain which ones are true and which ones are false. And it's a perfect format for history, because at the start you can go, like the Blackbeard one, here's all the things that you might know about him. And then we've got an expert on that one. You had Stu Goldsmith of the Comedian podcast. So you've got someone there to keep it light and keep it funny. It's just a fascinating way of going through, here's some amazing historical stories and tidbits. So how's that all coming about, and how is it to work on?
I'm so glad you enjoyed it, and I'm having a blast making it. The reason behind it, so the show's called You're Dead to Me, for a number of reasons. A, I thought that's quite a funny title.
Yeah.
But also, it's a show for people who don't like history. It's a show for people who forgot to learn any at school, is the tagline. Yeah. You know, if you went to school and you just, you're like, why am I learning this stuff? I don't care. I'm not interested. I'm 15. I want to go out and smoke and behind the bins, or I want to get off with people I fancy, or I want to go play football. And it's about trying to sort of help people get back into the idea of learning a bit of history, but, you know, not a huge amount. So what we're doing is quite ambitious in that we're trying to basically deliver like a university lecture with jokes.
Yeah.
So you're getting a proper expert, someone with a PhD who literally studies this every day. That's their job. We're getting professors in, we're getting PhDs in. But sat alongside them are top name comedians. So Sarah Pascoe, Joel Dommett, Desiree Birch, Richard Herring. You know, we've got fantastic people in every episode.
Love it.
And they are sitting there and going, hang on, what? And they're asking questions and they're having fun. They're being silly. They're being...
Sarah sounds like a great one to have on, because she's got such a thirst for knowledge as well. So her excitement to learn, she'll have a lot of knowledge and then have such excitement to find out more.
She'd also played Boudicca as a tour guide, which no idea. And she's from Colchester. Her family's from Colchester, which Boudicca burned down.
Oh, wow.
So she'd actually been Boudicca for like 10 minutes a day.
Love it.
So it was like, oh my God, that's an amazing connection. And Stu's from Bristol, where Blackbeard is from. So we always try and find a little way in.
Tie it together. I love it.
So we've had Desiree Birch talking about Harriet Tubman. You know, we're always trying to find a way to connect people in to a story. But what we're trying to do is quite bold, in that we're trying to deliver really high level knowledge to you, but in a way that you're always having a little giggle, having a laugh. It's being broken down for you by me as the host, our expert. Then the comedian is basically there to make sure that the audience's questions get answered or asked even. You know, they're there to kind of go, hang on, you're going too fast. I don't understand it. Or what does this mean? Or did that happen? And
the Alan Davis role.
The Alan Davis role.
All the time. It's what I do on the podcast a lot of the time. Rather than try and sound clever,
the curious amateur,
as stupid as possible for the listener.
But these people are obviously funny. So each episode is funny in its own way, but they've got a different vibe. Each episode has got a slightly different vibe, which I love. So the Harriet Tubman episode is really like powerful and emotional, because it's about, you know, an incredible woman in American history, a black heroine who just had a crap life and then was like, I'm not going to stand for this. Escaped from slavery and then went back in and freed the slaves that she could free, 800 slaves, lived this incredible life, but still sort of died in poverty. And that was a really powerful one. And the Blackbeard one is just really funny.
Man, there's so much stuff in there I loved. I loved the... And I'm not going to give all of it away, but I think there are some that's worth giving a tease. So I love that he'd essentially catfish people with the flags on his ship. So he'd put up the French flag if it was a French ship, so they'd feel safe. And then just before... I love the fact that it wasn't even that he'd go all the way there. Just before he'd get there, he'd switch it to a pirate flag and go... it's us, really.
It's like the Fonz.
And I love that. What was a few other? It's the fact that pirates wore a lot of jewels in their ears and fingers and stuff. And the reason for that was because banks didn't particularly exist,
no.
So you wanted your valuables on you.
You carry your wealth.
I love that. Another thing was that he essentially came up through an apprenticeship scheme.
Yep. Work experience.
That he was kind of a legal pirate for a long time, and then when he wasn't. when his kind of license ran out, he was like, I like this.
Yeah,
this
is, I'm good at this.
This is all right. the idea, there's only two more things I'm going to mention. The idea that pirate DVDs kind of makes some sense, because a lot of what pirates did was get stuff that wasn't readily available in your area, and or wasn't cheap, and sell it on the cheap, and you know, it's literally pirating.
It's a black market.
Yeah. But the one that blew me away was that he treated women kind of well.
Yeah,
for his time, he was kind of known as not the raping, pillaging type.
He's a bit murdery. He does a bit of killing, but he tries to avoid
had
violence.
Had a fair few wives.
Had a lot of. He's got a lot of wives. He has got a lot of wives, and you know, you're talking beyond 10. But he's a bit
woman
of
in every port, as the saying would
exactly
be.
But so he's a really interesting case study, and we had a lot of fun in that episode. It's a really funny one, and Stu's a very funny guy.
Yeah,
and Rebecca, our expert, really knowledgeable. And every episode we've done so far has been fantastic, but they're all a little bit different, which I really like, that they've all got their own personality.
Yeah,
it's not a sort of cookie cutter. This week we're doing this, and it's going to sound the same. Yeah. Each one has got a different individual take, because the expert is different, the comedian is different. And the subject matter, sometimes you've got to be more sensitive, sometimes it's quite problematic, histories, and sometimes you're having a real laugh. So we've done one on the history of LGBT identities with Susie Ruffle, and that was really, really interesting.
Fantastic.
You're talking about the history of lesbian people, gay people, bi people, trans people. It's sensitive stuff, and you've got to be careful not to say anything that, you know, is painful or hurtful, but you can still have jokes in there. You can still find humour in there. So I'm really proud of it, and we've done about 10 so far. There'll be 15 in the first series, and it'll be hopefully available on the podcast app.
I can't wait to hear all of them. I remember when I was younger and my car had a tape deck, I bought in the services, I bought the box thing of the Mark Steele lectures.
Oh, yeah, Mark's fantastic.
And that was just amazing for me, because I was someone who didn't enjoy school. I wasn't particularly great at school, and it was after school that I then got a thirst for knowledge. And part of that was because of the Mark Steele lectures, because he'd have these irreverent, funny little snippets of history lessons. And that's what it felt like with this. It felt like, wow, I'm going to have a whole series again that I'm going to want to just have on and learn and listen to them all a few times and let it sink in.
And the important thing for me is that we've got proper experts there.
Yeah.
So the stuff you're hearing is legit. It's proper, you know, it's university level education, but it's accessible because there's a comedian there and I'm there to make sure that, you know, no matter how many GCSEs you don't have, you're still going to go, I get this. It's fine. This is making sense to me. I'm learning some stuff. I'm having a chuckle. And they're only 45 minutes long. So, you know, that's the length of a commute, or, you know, pop it in your ears for nighttime and listen in the bath if you want.
I was literally going to say, I can tell you now it's the length of a bath, because that's how I enjoyed it last night. So that's perfect. Well, before I wrap things up, we talked a fair chunk about your new book that comes out next year. Can you tell me a little bit about your old book?
Yeah.
So that if anyone's listening now and they want to go and get something immediately, it seems weird to have spent so long on something they can't have and not touched upon the thing that they can have. So it was a million years and a day, and it was... from what I feel, it's, as I kind of have said earlier, it's exactly what I like about your tweets. It's making history accessible and funny and enjoyable to learn about.
Yeah, it's the idea was, how do I write a book that is readable for absolutely anyone on the planet, whether they've never read a book before or they love history books, you know, because some people love history books and read all history books, and some people hate books, or some people hate history and they will never read a history book. And I was like, how do I write a book for that person?
Yeah.
How do I get them? And the idea was to find something universal. And immediately I was like, okay, it's got to have to be daily life. It's got to be the thing that we all do.
Yeah,
the story of our daily life. So the book is structured around a modern Saturday, and you wake up in bed, and it's the history of beds, and you run to the crapper because you need the loo, and it's the history of the toilet, and the history of toilet paper and hygiene and sanitation. Then you take a shower, it's the history of hygiene, washing, baths, showers. Then it's the history of food, because you need breakfast, and you pop in a bit of breakfast. And then it's the history of communication, because you read your emails, you pick up the paper. Then it's the history of pets, you walk the dog. So I just go through a Saturday, and I go all the way back to the Stone Age. So the subtitle is A Million Years in a Day, A Curious History of Everyday Life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age.
Yeah.
So every chapter is essentially a kind of short essay starting in the Stone Age and finishing now. But it's got jokes. It's funny. It's lively. It's got Star Wars references and yeah. gags about Lady Gaga. The idea is to try and just on every page have loads of information, but you can literally read that one page and then put the book down.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of a book you can read in the loo, you can read it in the bath, you can read it.
It feels as if I'm referencing it a lot now, but it feels as if it will give you the same benefit as QI, that you'll enjoy yeah. it, be entertained, but you'll also be able to look smart in front of your friends. Go,
absolutely.
Oh, by the way, did you know that the reason we started having toilet paper was, you know,
absolutely. Kind of... And I've just come from this morning just doing a Radio 4 series based on the book, which you can probably listen to as well. It's called The Origin of Stuff. It's presented by Katie Brand, and we've done 6 episodes on the history of like a single object. So we've done the toilet this morning. And we've done the fork, and we've done a high heel shoe. And it's amazing that you can take a single object, like anything at all, anything in this room. Like I'm looking over there, you've got the telephone over there. Yeah. The history of the telephone. You can start, obviously, with the invention of the telephone itself, which is in the late 19th century. But actually, it's not that, because it's about the history of communication.
Yeah.
So you have to go back to the Stone Age. So you've got to go back to the invention of ciphers, you know, little symbols that people are writing on the walls of caves. Yeah. And incredibly enough, only like 10 years ago, archaeologists discovered that there are 26 symbols that keep showing up across Europe in caves from the Stone Age, from 30,000 years ago. One of them is a hashtag.
Oh, wow.
Which is mad.
That's bizarre, yeah.
So I gave a talk at Twitter a few years ago, and I told them that, and they were like, that's crazy. I was like, yeah, it's coincidence, because a hashtag's easy to draw, isn't it?
So they've just gone up, down, up, down.
Yeah. But there are these symbols in the Stone Age that people are using, and you can trace that history through to the development of writing 5,000 years ago, where people invent cuneiform in the Babylonian world, or hieroglyphs in Egypt, the idea of writing things. The idea of writing your thoughts on a piece of paper or papyrus and someone else being able to read it, that is telepathy.
Yeah.
That's communicating your thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
To someone else without saying it out loud. It's magic.
That's
it's
mad.
Genuinely
yeah.
fascinating.
Yeah.
And you can only do that when you've decoded a language that other people can decode as well.
Yeah.
So the telephone is at the end of that long, long, long history. So I talk about the, you know, the history of the phone.
The telephone is going to be one whose story has got the most unpredictable twist at the end, right? The fact that it went from being a thing to a thing that has all the information in the world on it, and we have in our pockets.
It's
and
crazy.
It's the most popular camera in the world. Like, Nikon or Canon or whoever would never have predicted that they were going to be overtaken by first Nokia and then Apple.
Yeah.
It's like, what, the phone people? Yeah, they're going to take away the market.
But it's phenomenal how powerful the phone is now in our society. As you say, the camera, the ability to use maps, navigation, communication technology, Twitter and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. But also security, personal security, private security, you know, your deep secrets, your bank codes. Our world is... So my phone at the moment is playing up. It's been a nightmare all week. I'm off to the Apple store to go and yell at them and go, oi, what's going on with it? The moment it stopped working, I just had a panic attack. I was like, my life is on this small box.
Yeah.
And I can't function. I don't know where to get anywhere.
When we're organising... you let me know it wasn't working in case there was any issues.
I was really worried. I was like, Tim, you can't get in touch.
My thought was, my reading of you is you're as boringly organised as I am, so we'll both be here at least 15 minutes early, which we were.
We were.
So I was like,
it's
not going to be a problem. We're not going to need our phones in this interaction.
No, but... I know, but like the idea of me just walking around London and not being able to use Google Maps or not being able to, I mean, I'm obsessed with Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the bloody time. I just suddenly realised my life is on this little box, and I just don't know how I exist without it. And that's terrifying, because I was 18 when I got my first phone.
Cross promotion here, but I was a guest on another BBC Sounds podcast called Switch Off, which is Connie Huck's new one, where she gets the guests to have a week off of all social media.
Oh, I'd struggle.
And that's kind of the challenge. The point she kind of explains beforehand is, look, if you fail, then we'll discuss that.
Mm.
You talk briefly on the phone beforehand, and then at the end of that week, you meet up and go over it. And I found it absolutely fascinating. It made me learn how much pointless stuff I do on social media, because when I came back, I didn't find myself feeling there was anything I needed to catch up on.
Oh.
Do you know? And it was kind of I'll continue from here then.
Really?
I know I'm on it constantly, but having that week off, I didn't feel, I need to go and just get up to date on this. It was just, here we are again. So it shows you how irrelevant a lot of it is.
I'm definitely addicted. I mean, my wife is always telling me I'm addicted to my phone, and my argument is that it's made my life so much better.
Yeah.
It's definitely helped my career, 100%. And it helps me do my job, which is communicating history to the public through jokes and silliness. But also, if you took it off me, I think I'd really get a bit...
I think we're in the worst position because we can use the excuse of it's our job and not look at how much time you're spending that isn't your job. And that's what was fascinating about this. The bits I was panicking about was, oh, I've got a podcast out on Wednesday.
Yeah.
What's going to happen if I don't post about it?
Yeah.
And in the end, nothing happened. I posted about it on the Friday because I went from Friday to Friday. I posted about it on the Friday and people heard about it and it was fine. But yeah, it's an interesting one there.
Definitely invested. I mean, I'm looking to maybe come down a little bit on the usage. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe just drop it slightly. But for me, it's a part of who I am now.
Yeah.
And the remarkable thing is about 5 years ago, because I write a lot of jokes on Twitter and some of them are crap because I'm not the funniest guy in the world, but I try. But I found that I was writing tweets that were exactly 140 characters long.
Yeah.
My brain was doing it.
Habitually,
just by doing it over and over and over. So it made me a much better writer. So when I now write
a good
books,
restriction.
I'm a much better writer because I do short, punchy sentences and I've got control of all my sort of phraseology. And when you read your own audiobook, I mean, you must have done this when you read an audiobook, you suddenly go, God, which dick wrote this? It's awful.
There's like, so much stuff
just stumbling on it and you're like, that's horrible to say and that's too long. You suddenly realise it's not.
I think the restrictions can be an amazing thing. It's why I mourned at the death of Vine, because it was great that it was such a restriction. Here's how long you've got to make your punchline, to make your gag, and then it's over.
Yeah, we've just done a Horrible Histories episode special about Victorian cinema, because the Victorians invented cinema in 1895, and the BFI gave us all this free stuff that we could use in the episode. An amazing episode, because it was a hybrid episode where we used the original black and white Victorian film in the episode, and then we dressed our actors up as the people in those Victorian films, and then we intercut between them making the film that you were watching, the Victorian film you're watching. Really exciting, and we're super proud of it. But those Victorian films were often 12 to 15 seconds long initially.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, that's mad. But then you go, but Vine was 15 seconds.
That's all you needed.
And that's all you needed. You got a gag out of it, you got a joke, or you heard something, and you're like, okay, now I know what you mean. You don't need
forces you to get straight to the point.
It really does. And
over a tweet that's only half the length that, you know, that's exciting to me. I'm like, they've made that gag in 10 words.
Yeah.
This is amazing. This is perfect. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll wrap things up now. I guess I want to ask what's ahead. My birthday is on August 3rd, and my birthday present from my goddaughter this year is that I'm taking her to go and see Horrible Histories live. So that's happening in August. And how's that? Kind of, how's all of that work? The translation to stage and
I'm not involved in that. That's a different company. That's the amazing thing about Horrible Histories. It's a huge brand, and they've got the books, which are amazing, which I don't work with. No, the magazines I don't work with. I just do the TV show and the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fantastic when you hear families going, "Oh, I brought my kids out. We went and saw the stage show, and it's amazing. I had a great fun time. And then we watched the TV show, and then I read them the book."
Yeah,
and you just go, "It's lovely that there's all these different ways in."
Yeah,
this,
and they're all
the
positive. They're all pushing in the right direction.
They're all celebrating. They're all inspiring kids to go out and read books about history, but also just books about other stuff.
Yeah.
Just to go out and. So the next thing for me is writing kids' books.
Yep,
that's the next
amazing
big step. I've had some really exciting meetings the past couple of weeks, and that's next in the line. And I'm not sure I can tell you this, but I've got a really exciting. I've had a really couple of interesting meetings with Netflix.
Right,
that's probably as far as I can go. But again, trying to do stuff for kids that's different and innovative and exciting. And
on Netflix, I think are some of the masters at the moment of
they're doing amazing
of
stuff.
Getting stuff off the ground. A Sex Education was really popular.
Show.
I've only just started watching it, but I was talking to a mate yesterday who's in the industry, and he was like, "That was with the BBC for ages. It was with Channel 4 for ages, and no one made it."
Yeah.
And Netflix went, "Oh, we will." And bang, it's this huge thing. It's not patronising anyone. It feels really a teen thing that's of its time. And
they're also the thing I love about Netflix is they've brought back the rom com.
Yeah,
I really love a rom com. I'm huge into comedy, as you can probably tell. Yeah. You know, I'm a historian, but my passion is comedy. But I love a rom com. I'm really into it. And they died in cinemas. They went through that phase of Matthew McConaughey sort of doing his sort of text and drawl and fancying Kate Hudson, and then they just didn't get made anymore. And Netflix have kind of brought them back, and they've recast
before
them.
The McConaughey-sense, as it's known, when he suddenly became an Oscar-winning
actor. He went from being kind of the guy who was handsome to being the guy who could properly act.
Everyone was shocked at that, and I was like, "Well, I was a fan of Dazed and Confused, which he was amazing in.
Exactly.
Also had Ben Affleck in, who did exactly the same, who did the rubbish rom-coms for years and then started to win Oscars.
But it's also like Nick Cage. Like Nick Cage is a sort of a running joke, and obviously, you know, people love his sort of his crazed facial expressions. Yeah. He's a great actor when you put him in the right thing.
Yeah, completely.
And sometimes he does shows for the money, sometimes he does films for the, you know, because it's working with an interesting director, but...
And you'll know as a historian that the love of realism in film is quite a modern idea in the past. Like you watch a lot of 50s and 60s films and they speak so unusually and all that. It's because the point wasn't realism. It's like a lot of people who are against the kind of the photorealism style of painting, their argument is, well, photos exist. Painting should be doing what photos can't.
Yeah.
And similarly, that was the idea of film for a long time. Mm. I love Shane Meadows and Steven, all these people who do this amazing realistic stuff. But equally, I don't think it's worth more or less than the more extreme and unusual, like a Nicolas Cage type.
Yeah, 100%. I love a deranged movie that... I love... So my favourite ever film is Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
For me, it's just a masterpiece in every direction. Like, it's a brilliant comedy, it's a brilliant musical, it's brilliantly made in a technical sense, it's funny, it's charming, Gene Kelly is the greatest. I've seen it 100 times, I will watch it 100 times more, it's incredible. But I also love, like, a proper action movie that knows what it is and does it properly, where things explode, people get, you know, Pacific Rim. Yep. I had a great time watching Pacific Rim.
Yeah, completely.
And I'm, you know, probably into the Marvel movies, of course, but I like a sort of stupid... action movie.
Particularly the latter end of the series, but the Mission Impossible films, a perfect
Fallout
example of that.
It's incredible.
Yeah, they're just these big, stupid action films, but they're amazing.
I mean, Fallout is one of the best films I have seen in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
It's flawless action film. You know, it's so weird. Well directed.
It's weird that it links, but that was a film I went to see on my birthday the year that came out. So it's,
that was your treat.
I have a history of going and watching things in comfy seats.
The Horrible Histories movie is out July 26th, so you can catch it.
That's perfect.
Also for your birthday, if you fancy a second treat.
100%.
And hopefully we'll get to make loads of them if it does well. If you go out and see it and support it, then we can get to...
I'm a massive advocate of that. I think people are... because of the accessibility of... entertainment, people are forgetting the experience of the cinema, and it is a different thing. And it's not just your big hard-hitting action films, it's all films, because you're in a dark room with no distractions, you're not looking at your phone, you're not even, just if you don't look at the phone at home, you're not looking around the room or hearing a car drive past, you're in a room where you're just paying 100% attention to what these people have slaved over, and I think it really gives us a different appreciation of films.
Yeah, I saw Booksmart last week.
Amazing,
isn't
it?
Love that film.
Absolutely
fantastic.
I loved it.
I'm so glad I saw it on a big screen, because it really just, it popped.
I couldn't agree more. I think people have that feeling of, oh, if it's not a huge... all singing, all dancing, CGI, I think I'll just watch it at home.
Yeah, stick
on the
telly.
I think you take them in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just remember seeing Phantom Thread a couple of years ago, and the soundtrack, you know, the score on that is so lush and beautiful and cinematic.
Not being able to look away from his performance in that adds to the performance so much, because it's such just an awkward and intimate performance.
Almost claustrophobic, and yet somehow beautiful.
Yeah, and having it there huge in front of you, and you can't kind of... There's nowhere to glance away. It's in your whole screen. Anyway, thank you very much. Obviously, what's your Twitter? It's Greg underscore Jenner, right?
Yeah, I'm really easy to find on Twitter. I'm the one with the stupid face and the stupid hair.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, pleasure meeting you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Greg Jenner. I hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was fantastic. God, you know what? You know, I was resistant on moving the rambling into the outro, but I feel far more relaxed doing it here, because you can just turn it off now and move on to another podcast. I feel like I can have a proper chat with you each week. So what have I been... I did a post on socials this week, and it's got the biggest reaction I've ever had, and that meant the world to me, because it's a really important one. So I'm a patron of Stammer, there you go, on cue, of the the British Stammering Association. And they've put up a load of billboards. They're digital billboards in certain places. And they have the words "I stammer," but the way the text is, there's room in those words to write stuff. And they've got little quotes written by people who stammer with bits of things that they wish people who didn't stammer knew. I'm going to read a few of them to you. I'm not nervous. It's how I talk. What I have to say is worth waiting for. Don't hang up on me. Please don't finish my sentences. Give me a little more give me just a little more time. All voices are equal. And yeah, it was really moving. I went and had my photo taken beside all of them. I waited for ages because it's a digital carousel and there's other adverts as well. But I did that post and it was really moving that it's the most interaction I've got. Because, I mean, you guys will know I've got a stutter because you listen to the podcast and I stutter on the podcast and I don't edit it out. But a lot of people who are into my music or have seen me acting might not know. I did a second post because this post got a lot of love, but a lot of it was love from people in the film industry who I really rate and want to work with. I'm going through now people like Ed Lilly, Desiree Akhavan, Josh Trank, Nat Sanders, just loads of Tez Ilias. He's a future podcast guest. Johnny Lee Miller. I'm not going to scroll through all of them. They're the ones that are jumping out on this first class. Myanna Burin, who I need to get on the podcast because she's ace. Yeah. So that's not me just name dropping. That's me explaining why I did a follow-up post to say, just so you know, when acting, I can normally get the stutter under control. So don't worry about cut. I didn't want to. Suddenly I was like, this is so moving. And then I thought, oh man, has this big stance just talk myself out of acting roles, because again I think we can't give it to the guy who can't speak properly. So I did a post saying I can get it under control, but also let's start writing some characters who stutter, but the stutter isn't their defining characteristic, because that's where people make the mistake of inclusion, is when they go inclusion, but the inclusion is the what they are is the defining thing. I had a great chat about this with Angel Dufria, who's got a robot arm. She's got a robotic arm and it's amazing. And she was saying the role that meant the world to her wasn't one of the many roles she had as a lab, either worker or patient. It was when she got a role as just a waitress. And she just happens to be a waitress who has a robotic arm. And things like that, that's when it starts to get inclusion and that starts to become worthwhile. So yeah. It was just, yeah, I'm not going to ramble. I've already rambled on too much, but it was lovely to have that and to have that interaction and response from you guys. Things I need to tell you about, obviously, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. Next week is, next week? No, the week after is Poem of the Month Day on patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. It's also new Pod Bible Day. So Pod Bible issue 4 is going to be out and we're going to be handing them out in Brighton and London, and I'm going to be handing them out in Edinburgh. So that'll be a week commencing August 5th. So that's exciting. Anything else I need to tell you about? Huge love came in for the Connie Huck episode and for my appearance on her podcast, Switch Off, which is also a BBC Sounds podcast. So yeah, that's been cool. Oh, that's what I need to tell you. I mentioned Patreon. So on Patreon, I always post a photo when I've recorded a new podcast. As this podcast goes out today, I'm meant to be recording a podcast with a guest that I reckon will be the most excited you guys have ever been about me having anyone on the podcast. I think it will probably be one of the biggest episodes, at least, I've done. Certainly one of the biggest of this year. And I will be posting that either today or tomorrow, hopefully on the Patreon. So genuinely, if you want to just, I mean, it's only a dolly. You can just pop on once and unsubscribe. It's a dollar a month. It's not much. But if you wanted to just jump on once, in fact, if you wanted to go and look, you pay the dollar and then you can listen to all the Poem of the Months because they're all on there still, and all the Distraction Pieces rewinds, and then delete it at the end of the month and you paid a $1 for all this stuff. But yeah, if you're going to ever do that, this week's the week, because got a bit of a guest recorded. It's weird because I was thinking of not putting it on the Patreon because it's not going to be released for a month. And I thought, well, I don't want everyone having all that excitement and then that excitement not being there when it actually comes out, because of that, the excitement has died down. But it's just so good that I think the excitement is going to just remain there and maintain. So, yeah. Anyway, I'll stop rambling on. If you enjoyed this episode, go back and check out a really early episode with a guy called Simon Singh. It's a really good, informative and interesting one. The original Dr. Susie Gage episode as well. They're these episodes where it's not necessarily a celebrity, it's an expert. And it's fascinating. The Akala episode also, obviously Akala is a rapper and all sorts of other things, but the Akala episode, it's Akala feels like more of a historian in that episode. It's amazing. The dude's so intelligent and so informed and well-read. So, yeah, there's some good ones if you missed them. All of them are smaller episodes, numbers-wise. So if you missed them, I recommend you go and check them out. But other than that, obviously on Saturday, I'll be... Oh, that's what I'm... I've hardly promoted this on the podcast at all. And I'm doing it right at the end of a long one as well, so no one's going to hear this. But I've got my club night at the book club. It happens to be my birthday gathering as well. It's within a week of my birthday, and I'm so busy at the moment that I'm not doing anything for my birthday other than this. So come on down, hang out. We've got Russell from Block Party DJing, myself DJing, Stu, Chris, DJ Destruction, Discotech Credits, the legendary Whiffwick. Yeah, it's going to be a good old night. I'll end it there. You've got plenty. I hope the sound was okay at the beginning, and if you were impressed, because believe me, it was. You couldn't listen to it originally. So Buddy Peace is an absolute beast. Love to Buddy Peace, but yeah, if you're impressed, he's the man to hit up if you've got your own podcast production needs. All right, I'll see you all next week when I'm joined by. Let's have a look at who I'm joined by next week. I'll get my little list up. You see, if I'm doing this at the end, I can be as long and rambly as I want. Whereas at the beginning, people get annoyed. Next week is the amazing Carrie Ad Lloyd. Now, that's one to get excited about, right? Look at me dropping that in casually. Really good conversation. You're going to enjoy that one. All right, I'll see you all then. Ta-ta!
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.